Well, you're going to have to use prayerful judgment. I'm not wise enough to make those decisions, but I would say this week has been a very good week, a very good week for that young lady. And I didn't go out of my way to find hard issues, but some of these issues are tough. And if we don't talk about them, well, where else can we talk about them? Where else can we talk about them? One thing to always remember, when our children don't respond spiritually like we want them to, never, ever, ever give up on them. We've got a young lady who's been back in our attendance a little bit the last 3 months. A young lady raised in the church, knows it as well as a lot of you. You just don't ever give up. I don't know where that's going to lead, but you just never give up. Never give up. Right, was that you, Jay? For your information, the one that made the comment about being made to go to church was 12 years old. The one that said, looking back, I'm glad they did, was 22 years old. Sometimes parents feel guilty about making their children do things spiritually. I don't feel any more guilty about making my children go to church than making them not play in the road or go to school. We've got this thing about we can't make our children do things spiritually. We don't have that hang up when it comes to secular things. Now, we should explain to them why. But young children aren't always able to make those best decisions for themselves. Don't feel guilty about it. Do it in a right way. Don't mess it up. There's just no other place they're going to reach these heights. Let me take a look at a couple of scriptures here. I do want to cut you off. But it's not because I don't value your comments. Proverbs 22 and 6. It's been raised a couple of times. And it's been explained several times. But I want to make sure that each time we talk about this subject, we do. Proverbs 22:6. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. And that causes many a parent to scratch their head, because I sure thought we raised our child in the Christian walk, and they're nowhere to be seen. Well, I think that's still a very painful scenario, but that's not what this passage is talking about. And if you've had this explanation, just bear with me, because from comments I've heard this week, it still hasn't registered with all of us. The phrase, train up a child in the way he should go, literally could and should be translated, train up a child according to his way. And what this passage is saying is, it's not saying if you bring your child to church and teach him all of the Bible stories and the plan of salvation that he's automatically going to be a Christian. That is not what this verse is saying. It's saying each child has a unique bent and has a unique personality. And you need to parent that child in accordance with that unique personality bent. You simply can't raise every child the same, because every child isn't the same. Now, we need to be consistent in our standards. But sometimes I'll hear parents say, I don't understand what happened. I had 3 children and I raised them all the same way, and one of them's in church and 2 of them isn't. Well, part of the problem is you had 3 children and you raised them all the same way and they weren't the same. Some of you have children that it takes a 2x4 across the side of the head to get their attention. And some of us were like that. Others of you have children that if you look at them for more than 1.5 seconds, they burst into tears. So you have to handle it. Now you have the same standards. You're teaching them the same morals, the same ethics, but you have to be discerning enough. And I believe what this passage is truly teaching us is be sensitive to those bents or the ways of those children. And when they grow older, they won't depart from it, or they will develop better because of your sensitivity to how to train them. I believe what that passage is saying. Now, certainly, we should train our children in the Christian walk. And certainly, we feel bad when they don't respond. And sometimes, we ought to feel bad because we have just done a poor job. But that's not an automatic. Just because our children don't always walk as we would like them in the Lord doesn't necessarily mean we've been bad parents. And it's a fine line. I don't want to let us off the hook by saying we're not responsible for our children's conduct after they leave the home, because I think we are. But I don't want us to have such a guilt trip that if they choose not to, my sons are 24 and 21. If they've been raised, it's over. I mean, essentially, they come to me occasionally for advice, but their decisions are theirs. If implanted in their minds aren't the values that I hold, I'm not going to probably do it from here on out. One of them lives at home, the other one doesn't. It's irrelevant. They're raised, good or bad. People will say, well, what do you think about this that they did? Or what do you think about this girl they're dating? I don't have an opinion. Well, no, I do have an opinion. I don't have any input. I don't have any input at this age, unless they choose to ask me, and that isn't going to happen. That isn't going to happen. I don't know anything about those things. Christy. Okay, the passage, well, of course, it's in the Decalogue in Exodus 20, but it's in Ephesians chapter 6. Honor your father and mother. I think that's directed at all ages, but I think it takes a different form. Okay, I think, well, let's look at Ephesians 6. I think there are two components of that. Ephesians chapter 6, I think it's verse 2. But in verse 1 it says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. I think there are two elements there. One is obedience in verse 1, and the other is honor in verse 2. I think obedience passes. Obedience is only in effect to the extent that we're under the rule of our parents. Honor, I don't think, passes, although I think it changes. For a young child, part of honoring their parents is obeying them. For you and I, part of honoring our parents at our age isn't obeying them. But it is showing respect, it's showing love, it's wanting what's best for them. Sometimes it entails caring for them. But you and I are now in a different relationship. Your primary responsibility isn't to your parents. And maybe I picked a bad example because your parents are gone, but it still holds true. Your responsibility changed when you married Dave, and you and he are a family unit, so you couldn't be obedient and in proximity and do all of those things without negating your promise and responsibility to your husband. But we should always try to treat our parents in an honorable way, and that may mean caring for them, as an example. It may be going and asking them for advice, even when you don't want it, so that they feel good that they're still included. It may mean taking care of their needs. There's all kinds of ways to honor people. And I'll say this I think they would take this right. I maybe shouldn't say this, but one of the things we did this meeting was have Bill Hensley and my dad speak. Well, why do you think we did that? It was a way to honor them for their years of service. Were they the two most dynamic, energetic, best speakers we could have found? No. because they've lost a little edge. But it was an honor, and it was a great privilege for some of you that had heard them all your life to kind of hear them one more time. And I don't denigrate their sermons at all. I thought they had excellent points. But that was a form of honoring. That was a form of honoring. We could have gotten men who had a little more energy. Absolutely. But that's not always the most important thing, is it? Not always the most important thing. Christy, do you have some follow-up on that? There's so many ways we honor our parents. Well, the specification in the Lord refers to obey, not to honor. Okay. Right. Theoretically, that's true. If your parents are in the Lord, they're not going to give you ungodly advice, although they could. But I view this phrase "in the Lord" not to be modifying the parents. I view that to be modifying you obey your parents because that's the way the Lord wants you to conduct yourself. That's right. That's right. Under the old law, oftentimes, obedience and physical blessings were tied very closely together. I don't think that necessarily carries over as much to the new law. Otherwise, we get into a prosperity gospel. Obey God so you'll be prosperous. But in the old, under the old law, that did occur. Absolutely. I don't believe honoring our parents ever ends. The way you do it changes. The way you do it changes. Tim? Yeah. I think honor is tied into manners. That's right. I couldn't tie it in. I don't know how to tie it in any more to that. I think to be rude is an unhonoring position to take. And many homes are simply not taught. Lita? You want him to leave? I believe the way you honor them is the same way you love them. Even if they don't respect you and even if they don't treat you right, we as children and we as Christians are to treat people with the idea of doing what is best for them and putting them in that position, even though they don't deserve it. This doesn't say honor your parents if your parents are honorable. That makes it easy, but that's not what the verse says. Nabal's children should honor him. It'd be tough. And those of us that are blessed with parents a little better than Nabal have a lot easier task. Let me touch on a couple of other things here, then we'll go back. Some of the problems, I think, that parents have, and this is a little bit more for those of you that are still in the process. As I go through the Bible, some of the sins of parenting that I find, number one is favoritism. And we touched on that a little bit the other day. Genesis chapter 25, verse 28, there seems to have been some favoritism in the home of Isaac regarding Jacob and Esau. Be very, very careful that you don't even inadvertently give the impression that
one is more special than the other. Number two, not restraining our children. You remember the story of Samuel, of Eli. In 1 Samuel chapter 2 and 3, his two sons, the real sin of Eli in those passages was not that his sons were rebellious. The real sin of Eli was that he did not correct them. And you won't all agree with me, but if we don't correct our children when they're young and teach them how to respect authority, they're probably not going to learn it later, and it's going to cause them problems in their home life and in their spiritual life. And I am an advocate of corporal punishment. And I've just told you what I think of it, so I guess I don't have to. I just think there is a place for that. I'm not talking about beating them, but there certainly has to be restrictions. And if you don't believe it's appropriate to spank your children, that's your choice. But you may remember back and wonder why you didn't. I love Marvin's comment, and I have a lot of respect for Marvin Engel when it comes to parenting. He doesn't think I should, but he has four children all raised in the church, and he may not remember this except when I keep reminding him. One time, he made the statement, "When my children ask for a spanking so bad, I hate to disappoint them." I like that. Number three is just the presenting of a bad example. Sometimes we want our children to grow up to be Christians in ways we weren't willing to be. And we wonder why they don't. Another fault that sometimes we as parents exercise is to let anger creep into our relationship. Correcting our children in a fit of anger is never the right thing to do. I did it once. And I think the scars are minimal, but I still remember it. And I'm going back 15, 16 years, and it was over something very silly. But it hit me at the wrong way. I guess I can share it with you very briefly. I had these wonderful tomato plants, and I had really nurtured them. And the boys decided to go out in late June when I had these wonderful green tomatoes and have a tomato fight. And I went out there, and I didn't have a tomato on the thing. So I tried to figure out how you make fried green tomatoes. I never did figure that out. But I did correct them, probably in a tinge of anger. My dad happened to be there when it happened, and he left before I corrected them. But it wasn't the time to do it. I should have cooled off just a little bit. So anger's not an appropriate thing. Another key of parenting, I believe, is to understand that you need two elements. You need love and respect. Love naturally occurs. Our children are going to love us, but they won't automatically respect us. We have to earn their respect. I believe Jonathan loved Saul. I don't believe Jonathan respected Saul, and you see the consequences. And I think families seldom fail when they're in a balance. Things as parents we need to always remember to try to do is to listen. And most of us aren't good listeners. My wife is a far better listener than I. And so when our children wanted someone to listen, they went to the kitchen, because listening was a lot better there. When they wanted something solved, they might gravitate toward me. But I wasn't, and I'm not always a very good listener. I'm a problem solver. And sometimes people don't want their problem solved. They simply want someone to listen to them. And if we as parents can learn how to be better listeners, they'll talk to us more. Always remember that your job as a parent is to work yourself out of the job. And one of the most difficult things to do is let these precious little things go. But it's a catch-22. We're upset if they don't leave, and we're upset when they do leave. So you can't win. But I think in the long run, you're better off if they do leave, and I'm sure they're better off. Children want to mimic our good examples. Give them every good example you can possibly give them. Above all, instill spiritual faith in your children and use the church as an avenue to help instill that. For everything I taught my children, people in the church have taught them two or three. And some of you have taught my children lessons that they wouldn't have accepted from me because I was dad. But they'd accept it from Uncle Charlie or Aunt Irma or whomever. And I guess, always remember, if you've been blessed, and most of you have, with a good godly mate and good godly children, cherish them and respect them, and always pray to the Lord to have the wisdom to do what's best. But if it doesn't all work out the way we would like, always remember, God was a wounded parent too. And that doesn't mean he's not a perfect parent. It just means children don't always do what we know is best for them. Got a few minutes. I'll pause and see if you have any other comments. Chad? But the wayward children are a tremendous pain. There was a couple here last night, I'm not going to tell you who they were, who not long ago told me, if we knew what we know now, we would have never had children. And just referencing the pain. Just referencing the pain. And that's too bad. Knowing what I know now, I would have had two boys. Fonda? Very good. Very good. Thank you for sharing that. David? I think that certainly is a true sentiment. I'm not sure that that's his primary emphasis in this verse, but I certainly agree with your sentiment. And that's why you never quit praying for them. It's in there. I don't know if they're not all going to come back, but some of them will. And you keep praying for them. Some of them may come back, but it may not be in our lifetime. But you keep praying for them. You never give up. Joanne? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely, and thank you for that comment. There was a man restored, well, within the last month at a congregation in Des Moines. And I know for a fact a major part of that restoration was the impact of his children and his grandchildren. Absolutely. Excellent point. Yes, sir. Can I touch on it? Not very deeply, because I don't have much. Her comment is patience. Obviously, patience is always a virtue. In 1 Corinthians 13, it's one of the 15 brushstrokes that describe love, is patience. And I think parents ought to always be patient with their kids. That doesn't mean we don't correct them, and that doesn't mean we aren't firm with them, but patience, to me, is the antithesis of doing things out of anger. But patience, in terms of parenting, doesn't mean we tolerate all conduct. That's not loving. Patience means that when we do have to correct in the context of parenting, we do it, pardon me, out of love and not in anger. Do you have more that you would like to say on that? Or is there an area that you had in mind? Sure, sure. And patience is a hard thing in and out of the family and in and out of the church. In and out of the church. Kathy? And we parents are human. I mean, patience is a great thing to talk about, but sometimes you're just out of it, and you wonder how that could be that stupid. But I struggle with that in the church. I mean, I sometimes in my church work, I just say, how can people be so stupid? And I don't know, but I need to be patient. Chris? And certainly patience ought to manifest itself in inaction more as they're older and away from the home. When they're under our roof and we're raising them, we've got to be involved. We've got to be, and they want us to be involved. They want us to be involved. You want to hit the buzzer back there for me? Ali? Absolutely. Absolutely. He said the prime time when we're most tempted to be critical is in the car on the way home from church. And we'll make a comment like, well, that was really a duddy lesson. Well, maybe it was. But boy, that's not what our kids need to hear. The converse of that might be good, though. If it's an exceptionally good service, you talk about that all the way home. They're going to learn as they grow up, but we don't need to discourage them. We don't need, we do that enough. Sure. Sure. Yeah. Very good. Okay. We'll... Tomorrow we're going to look at marriage, divorce. I was asked a question about that today. I'm going to try to remember to cover that tomorrow, and if I don't, the person that asked me reminded me. I'm not trying to look at that person right now. But we'll talk about divorce and remarriage and the impact those things have on the family.
But we are so blessed with this group of young people we have. I mean, I'm not talking about Smart Road, I'm talking about here. I can't say this week, 2 weeks has gone flawlessly, but it's gone almost flawlessly compared to how it could have gone as it relates to the conduct of our young people. And I've had the privilege of being around these kids for the last 8 or 9 years, and I wouldn't want them to hear me say this, but there's some awful good kids. Some awful good kids. Excuse me, does anybody have an announcement? Gave us a brain is so we could take his principle and apply it in a Christian way. The issue of marriage, divorce, and remarriage to me is so simple in concept that I only need 2 or 3 sentences to explain my understanding of the issue. Number one, God honors marriage and wants every single person who's married to stay married. Period. Number two, if there is sexual infidelity in a marriage bond, Jesus indicates that the innocent party is free to divorce and remarry if they have a partner who has been sexually unfaithful to them. But having said that, it is never God's desire, if at all possible, that that be done. God always prefers reconciliation because he always honors the marriage above all other relationships other than the Christian relationship to God. And number three, I do not believe, and I believe the Bible will support this, that anyone who is divorced for any other reason than sexual infidelity of their mate has any right, way, shape, or form to remarry. Period. Now, you won't all agree with me, but that's my understanding of scriptures, and it's wonderful that it shouldn't take us long to express our understanding of scriptures. I believe there are 2 reasons in which a person may remarry if their marriage has been broken. I just expressed one of them to you. One is if their mate has been sexually unfaithful, but even then God prefers reconciliation over divorce. And of course the other one would be in the death of a mate. And their reconciliation is simply not an option because marriage is a temporal physical institution, and once that physical entity has been removed through death, there obviously can't be any reconciliation. I'm going to interweave a couple of questions that I've been given, and then I'm going to pause. In the case of physical or emotional abuse, is an individual right in divorcing in the case of an abusive mate? And if they divorce, do they have the right to remarry? It seems to me the tenor of scriptures is such that God does not expect an individual to be physically abused. Now, usually we think of this in terms of the wife being abused, but I think there are cases where the husband could be abused and has been physically. I don't think the tenor of the Bible teaches to me that a woman would have to stay in a relationship in which she is physically abused and physically threatened. I don't think God expects a woman to have to stay in a marriage where she is endangered. But having said that, I believe Scripture teaches that if you get divorced for any other reason than sexual infidelity, you have no scriptural right to remarry. So if an individual chooses to break their marriage vis-a-vis a divorce, even for physical abuse, I do not believe Scripture gives them the right to remarry. Now that sounds harsh, But before you disagree with me, make sure you're disagreeing with me and not disagreeing with Scripture. And why would God place us in what might seem like such a harsh and in some instances almost an incompassionate thing? I think it's to emphasize to us how important the initial selection process is. Bill. Yeah, verse 12, let me read that verse so that we have it in context. Bill is asking about Matthew 19 and 12. For there are some eunuchs which are so born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which are made eunuchs of men, and there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdoms of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. I think this goes along with some of Paul's comments in 1 Corinthians 17 about singleness. Here a eunuch, as I understand it, is someone who either emotionally or physically doesn't require the sexual intimacy for whatever reason. I think Jesus here is saying what Paul reemphasized, that if you are able to conduct yourselves so that you don't have to be sexually tied in an intimate relation, that's a good thing because it will free you up to be more available for the work of the Lord. He does not bind that on us because in the latter part of verse 12 he says, if you're able to receive it, it's good, receive it. But he's understanding that not everyone is going to be able to live in that context. I don't think he's preaching that that self-mutilation or castration is a positive thing, but if one can live in singleness, you're obviously going to have more energy and more time to serve the Lord. Do you have a follow-up question or a comment to help embellish that?
Do you feel like that this should be used in the context of not remarrying?
I think the question is, could this be used in the context of not remarrying? I think it could be used in that context in the sense that if one has lost their mate and is able to live alone and devote themselves more fully to the work of the Lord, I think that's a very positive thing. Just like Paul said, it would be positive even if you'd never been married. I don't think this is a stipulation that says it's wrong to remarry, because we're all different. Some, if you lose your mate, have no interest in looking for a second mate. Others just seem to fall apart if they don't have a companionship and a mate. I think it would be a positive thing, but you shouldn't do it if it's going to lead you to undue temptation, i.e. fornication or sexual impurity. Tom?
I think in the context he's answering the previous saying, that they thought that because what Jesus was saying is so hard, it would be better just never get married. And Jesus said, well, not all men can receive that.
Sure. Yes, and Paul expresses, I believe, that same principle in 1 Corinthians 7. He said, if you can, it's better that you don't get married. He wasn't anti-marriage. He was just talking about available time. And anyone that's married and has a family, you know, to do it right, it consumes a lot of time. God's not anti-marriage and anti-family, or he wouldn't have put that as one of the stipulations for elders and deacons. But there are some people who have, and I don't think it's wrong to call it an ability or a gift to withstand this. Most of us aren't in that category, but some are. Joanne? Are we talking about marriage, divorce, and remarriage? Okay.
Because some people say that, you know, this is how God feels about marriage and divorce and everything. You sanctify with him whether you're a believer or not. So, you know, they call it confusion.
Sure. Her question is, do these verses that I'm reading, Matthew 5, Matthew 19, 1 Corinthians 7, do they apply to everybody or do they just apply to Christians? That's Joanne's question. Well, I think the principles are solid principles for everybody. But I think Scripture is given to guide God's people. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean I think divorce and remarriage by people in the world is right. It's just they're lost. If you're not a baptized believer and a Christian, you're lost. So no matter what you do, you're lost. And until you come to the Lord, that's not going to change. I believe that what people do prior to coming to the Lord is in a different category than what they do after they come to the Lord. Not that it's right, it's just that if you're lost, you can't get any worse off. Whereas if you're saved, you can get worse off. You can lose your salvation. Now the question often comes up, and it may be underlying Joanne's question, what about people that have been married, divorced, married, divorced, married, divorced, married, divorced, and then they come to the Lord? Well, I believe that whatever you do prior to coming to the Lord and being baptized, I believe baptism washes away our past. And therefore, and I'll use an extreme example, someone's been married and divorced four times, and then they come to the Lord. What should they do? I think 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 24 says, in whatsoever state a man is when he comes to the Lord, let him therein remain. I think baptism washes your past away. If you're married when you come to the Lord, God wants you to stay married to that person. But now the rules of divorce and remarriage apply to you in a more strict sense because you're now a child of God and you have something to lose, i.e. your salvation. Was that your question? Okay, good, because I took a little long talking about it. Anybody else want to make a comment or question? Doug?
Did I understand you right that you were, and I'm not putting kind of the words in your mouth, I'm trying to ask the question.
I understand.
Would you say that Jesus here in both the scriptures in Matthew is teaching that if your man is unfaithful,
What I believe those two passages in Matthew 5 and 19 say that if our mate, or if we, maybe that's a more appropriate way to say it, are sexually unfaithful, the innocent mate has the right to divorce and remarry. However, that's not God's preferred. God would prefer reconciliation. There's two issues here. Number one, do you understand what I'm saying? And then number two, do you agree with it? And you don't necessarily have to take both of those steps at the same time.
I understand what you're saying. I looked at that verse a little bit.
Okay, would you want to comment on it?
To me, when I look at that verse, it's teaching.
Are you in Matthew 19?
Well, you can take me.
Okay. Understood.
But except for the case of adultery, in which she's already done that to herself, you're not causing her.
Okay.
The second statement there is anyone who marries somebody who is divorced commits adultery.
Okay. Okay, it may be a harder line than I was stating. I didn't hear you say anything I disagreed with, so I'm still not quite clear on the distinction, but there may be one. Let's look at verse 9 and verse 19 if there's interest, and we'll just go through it. Whosoever shall divorce or put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, commits adultery. I understand that to mean if we put away our mate for any other reason than our mate's unfaithfulness, we don't have the right to remarry because when we remarry, we commit adultery. That's my understanding of that verse. But I am not saying that if our mate is unfaithful, we have to get a divorce In fact, I'm urging us to do everything we can to reconcile. But it seems that relationships are built on trust, whether we're talking about parenting, and this is the ultimate breakage of trust in this marriage bond, which is probably, in my opinion, why God puts this in here. God didn't tell me why he put this as the exception clause, but it seems like that intimacy is a real breaking of trust. Now let me caution us that we can use this as an out clause and abuse it. We can use this as an out clause and abuse it. And I'm going to share with you opinion, but I believe if a couple gets divorced for a reason other than fornication, and later fornication occurs, I am not at all comfortable preaching that that person has the right to remarry, because the divorce was not for fornication. We have to be very careful that we don't put ourselves in a position of divorcing someone, which of course should then end the sexual relationships, setting tide until that person does something that we would construe of, and then we say, okay, now we're free. You can start trying in your minds to play games with God, and you may fool me and I may fool you, but we're not going to fool him. So I would caution us to be very, very careful. Now, I express that as my opinion. There are some issues on this that I have opinions on. I feel strongly about them, but unless I have scripture, I'm not going to bind them on someone else, even though I would express that thinking to them in a counseling session. Glenn?
Okay. Okay.
Lowell?